I'm Matt Booker.
I'm Dave Laird.
And I'm Yonina Hoffman, describing two perfectly circular motions on two distinct axes here in the great concavity.
Welcome, Yonina, to the Great Concavity.
Yeah, episode 48. Thanks so much for joining, Yonina. It's great to have you.
Oh, thank you guys so much for having me. It's great. I'm really honored to be on the show.
Oh, sweet. That's very nice of you to say. Yonina, for those who maybe don't know you yet, give us a little bit of background about what you're doing academically right now. You're kind of at a very exciting precipice, I would say, with where you're at in your doctoral research. And maybe give us a bit of background and what you've done with Wallace Studies so far, conferences you've gone to, things like that, and just let the reader know what you're about.
So I'm a PhD candidate at Ohio State University, and I am right up against my dissertation defense, which is looking to be at the beginning of August, and I've got a single author project, so my entire dissertation is about Wallace. I write about narrative voice across Wallace's career and use Wallace to kind of help refigure what we mean when we talk about voice, because I think that part of what makes him so exceptional is his special ability to manipulate voice in lots of different ways. Mm-hmm. And finally, I try to trace a career arc of what he's doing with voice at each moment in his career and how he is capable of advancing what he does, because he's never interested in staying the same. So that's the sort of snapshot of my dissertation.
Right, cool. And tell us, who is your supervisor?
I work with Brian McHale of postmodernist fiction fame. And right. I also work with James Phelan, who is an amazing scholar of rhetoric in the novel.
Very cool. Yeah, I was very psyched to learn about Brian McHale being your supervisor, because I used some of his, some of his articles and books during my own, time as a student doing work on Wallace. So that was very cool to hear about. And so you and I and Matt, I think we met 2 years ago at the conference in Illinois. So that was kind of our introduction to you.
Yeah.
At least mine, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I'm not sure if I met you, Dave, but I met Matt at the first conference, I believe, which attended.
That's right.
So, yeah.
So you go way back already.
Well, I made it out to the first one, and partly I go to like different conferences, and one of the ones I go to happens to overlap a lot with the Wallace conference, so I try to stagger them and come out every couple of years. I really love it.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to the conference in Austin, too.
Mm-hmm.
2020. It's going to be great.
It is. It's shaping up.
But I always feel, one reason why I wanted to have you on the show, Yonina, is I always feel like those conferences can be very rushed. And especially, I just never have enough time to sit down and actually have, a proper conversation. It's just like, hey, good to see you. What are you working on? Okay, what are you doing? When is that? Okay, yeah, I'll see you later. And it's like, yeah. I feel like that with a lot of people, and I feel like we're always like ships in the night, sometimes like you and I, we've crossed paths, and like at the one, I think it was last year or the year before, where you wrote about Updike. I think that was last year, right? And I was like, oh my God, finally we have someone, engaging with Updike. Because in 2017, we had Jim Plath at the conference, who was the president of the Updike Society.
Yeah. That was the year I went. So I was the same year, because I remember you guys recording with him.
Yeah. Yeah. Was that a cool moment for you, that synergy?
Oh, it was so cool. Yeah.
Because I still haven't really touched much Updike at all. So. I was out of my depth on that, but I'm sure you were right in there. Total Philistine.
Philistine. Filthy, hey man, amateur.
Political casual. Reasons, I stay away. I'm just kidding.
It's fair enough, but I was very... I mean, I'm in the minority on this, right? Most people, I think, are like you, Dave, so it's very, exciting for me to see someone else
writing
about Updike.
Yeah.
And what I believe to be not a completely dismissive way.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Like
I
Wallace
mean,
wrote about him.
Right. I like at least there's once. Certainly a lot to worry about, say, with Updike, or at least a lot of questions that you might be inclined to ask. But also I think that there's a lot to his writing that's positive, and a lot that Wallace found in it that he, you know, found incredibly useful for his project. So, you know, you got to see all sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I want to dwell on this for a little bit, because whenever I was an undergrad and I was a very naive, uneducated fellow, but I did like John Updike's work because he was like a generalist, and I could sort of relate to him in that he would do, you know, kind of art reviews for the New York Review of Books, but he would also do like really kind of trashy romance stuff. and he would write, you know, I was just very naive, and I told one of my professors, like, oh, I really like Updike. And she was like, that fucking golf playing misogynist, I would never read this old man. So, and I was just like, oh shit, like, am I on the wrong side of history here already? But I was very much like, you know, I just assumed like all of these smart people who have English degrees had read John Updike, and they were just like, never read that golf playing, you know, divorcee, middle brow, just all the worst things that I was like, and I was like, I don't like golf either. But I mean, yes, golf. It made me look at it as like, you know, I hadn't read everything by him at that point. And, I was like, oh yeah, he is kind of like your grandpa, politically speaking.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think the more he gets into his career, the more he's aware of that. You know, especially if you think about the arc of the Rabbit novels and the way that the Rabbit character goes from being in some way a self-conscious and self-critical, avatar for Updike's persona to being this sort of pathetic old man that even you can tell, you know, the author does not incline you to really align yourself with him. You know, he knows, and in some way
he's pathetic.
Yeah. He in some way says, like, is it possible to love that grandpa even if X, Y, and Z?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, because Updike wrote so much, he is very much hit or miss for me. And there are plenty of his books where I think, oh yeah, I would never go and read that again. But he did like even take a stab at like writing a post 9/11 novel and like the terrorist thing.
Oh yeah.
And he was a very adventurous writer. I don't think it's a great book, but a very adventurous writer, and the way that a lot of other writers get sort of pigeonholed as one thing or the other. It's like, oh, well, you're a encyclopedic novelist, or you're a postmodern novelist. Where it's like, Updike, he kind of avoided a lot of those labels just by being so much of a generalist.
Yeah. I think if we were
not
to...
super popular with the young people either. Like,
no.
How is that? Yeah.
I think if we were to say that there's anything that Updike conceives of himself as, that he would conceive of himself in some ways as a moral novelist in a very capacious way, because of the sort of like changing role of theology and ethics in his fiction.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think he didn't start out that way. I think he started out, you know, writing short stories for pay and writing about, you know, his thinly veiled life. but he always had this really kind of strict moralism streak, and very much became, you know, the way that he would govern his writing. I don't know how much that is actually grounded, you know, in his life per se, where he's known for, you know, things like adultery and I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting argument. But let's go back. So what you wrote about, or what you presented at a conference, was about Updike and Wallace, and actually a surprising term to me, about New Sincerity. Is that right?
Yeah.
Was that there? So not something often applied to Updike.
Yeah, I get that impression.
Right. Well, I guess what I was doing in that paper was I was trying to say that what Wallace does in trying to find a touchstone for his new sincerity is actually turn to Updike and increasingly try to adopt an Updikean prose style.
Well, that, again, I just don't think many people have made this point. So, like, I hope not.
Yeah, so, you know, I've since then sort of fleshed that paper out into a full article that I've sent out right now, so I'm hoping it's going to see print relatively soon.
Nice.
And so basically it's has to do with Updike's prose style and a kind of a, what Wallace calls a lushness of vision, and a little bit less, his, it has also to do with the way that his sentences are a little bit more controlled and tightly organized than the way that Wallace's tend to portray themselves. So Wallace, in an attempt to kind of create a readerly effect of stillness, turns to a kind of an Updikean prose that's sort of very concerned with lengthy artistic nature descriptions, you know, continued engagements in describing the body, describing the sensuousness of the body, and also something that kind of goes through Updike's fictional career and something that I think we all know that Wallace plays with is an attention to light and the way that light casts on it on scenes, the way the light falls on objects and stuff like that. So these are kind of like the sort of aesthetic things in Updike's prose that I think I see Wallace turning to and engaging with and adopting in certain ways.
Yeah, that's interesting because usually it's you know defined as something more like just lack of irony or cynicism, and I think that's probably also true. Do you deal with that at all, or do you get more into the aesthetic part of it?
I try not to talk too much about irony because irony is such a wiggly phenomenon, and
sure.
I think that you know the kind of irony we see in Wallace is one thing. Updike's fiction, I'm pretty sure Marshall Boswell has said, is sort of in its own way the epitome of irony. So I think there may be different ironies. So I don't necessarily try to say, oh, we're like abandoning irony, but more that we're re-engaging with questions of ethics through a particular prose voice, through a particular style that's combined with different values and attitudes.
And voice, that gets into what your dissertation is about, right?
Right.
So you started to talk about three different sort of modes or voices of Wallace: comic, encyclopedic, and sincere.
Yeah.
That's kind of the lay of the land for your dissertation.
Can
you walk us through those a little bit?
So like what I've been talking about with Updike has to do with the sincere voice. And let me just back up a second and say what I mean when I talk about voice, because it's obviously it's a pretty freighted term. What I mean when I talk about voice is a particular kind of textual effect that we experience as readers, that we feel like this is the narrator. And sometimes that makes us feel like we're close to the author. What that's made up of is it's an incredibly multitudinous sort of coalescence of things. We've got style, which is in my account diction, syntax, stuff on that kind of textual level, fine-grained. And then we've got tone, which has to do with attitude. So that's a place where kind of irony or cynicism or sincerity seems to settle in, right? Mm-hmm. What kind of attitude can we tell that this narrator is presenting the story with? What's the attitude towards the story? And then finally, the final component of values of voice is values. So how can the attitudes that we've seen and the things that they're about and the way that the story is told, what does all that tell us about what this narrator finds important, what this narrator values, what So maybe ethical or conceptual commitments the narrator or the narrating persona might have. And I think that that last one, you know, it gets a little bit further away from style because it does emerge through so many moments in a text. You can't necessarily point to one place and say, like, that's where the values are. Mm-hmm. But right. In terms of assessing sort of who might be speaking to us as readers, it's really important.
Hmm. That's good background.
So anyway, so that's voice. So then when I say that there's these three voices, I say that there's sort of like three main positions or attitudes, voices that become dominant at different moments in Wallace's career. So Brim and the System has this comic voice, and it's very silly and flighty and like it's very interested in humor for its own sake. Mm-hmm. So you see a lot of slapstick, you see a lot of body humor in Brim of the System. And those are the kinds of moments that I look at in that chapter. And ultimately, I also argue that a lot of them come from Pynchon, which is, I don't think, a very big surprise.
Right.
But part of what I do is I try to actually link particular specific moments in Broom to specific moments in Pynchon and show how finely Wallace is both imitating and then sort of torquing what Pynchon does.
Mm-hmm. You said a funny thing to me last week when we were hanging out in Victoria because you were in town. That you've read Broom of the System more times than you wanted to as a result of this research. And I said, like, oh, what, like 6 times or something? And what did you say?
I don't know.
Like
what I
two
say.
And
like
a three, half three, or something?
2.5, yeah.
I was like, oh, that's twice as many times as you wish you'd read it.
A little bit.
I gotta say, I have like no desire to reread it, really.
Yeah, I've read it once, you know, like a decade ago. And there are parts that really stand out to me as hilarious that I think about often, like, you know, the Snickers bars and the Weight Watchers scene and the Nine Steaks, Norman Bombardini stuff, like, just kills me.
Oh, those Nine Steaks, yeah, they're like...
The infinite growth program that he has, Operation Total Yang.
I mean, I think that's based... that's a lot of that is based on a Monty Python
sketch. Yeah, totally, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the stuff is based on a John Irving story about the guy, the Nesquik, giving like CPR, mouth to mouth, and even poison. So you've written about in this dissertation is Broom of the System, Infinite Jest, and what's the other one? Pale King.
The Pale King, yeah.
Yeah, and then your MA thesis you was on the Pale King, is that right?
Yeah, that is right.
So. To me, when I think of Wallace and voice, the first thing that comes to mind is the stories in Girl with Curious Hair. What do you make of what he's doing there in terms of voice?
I think he's playing a lot, which is why I don't necessarily talk about them too much in the dissertation. You know, I had to like draw some lines about how much ground I could cover, but I think that there's this kind of movement where the stories are in some way sort of incubators for style, for voice, for trying things out and seeing how much sort of like textual momentum they can create. And sometimes they don't really create a lot, but they're still amazing in the short form. And sometimes they start kind of pushing and pushing Wallace to kind of write more and more. And so, like, yeah, Curious Hair, I mean, I think you see voices in Curious Hair that don't really get replicated super much, like the title story and the way that it kind of does this catatonic realism that, you know, is so often is attributed to Brittany Snellis. Hmm. I mean, you know, he tries it, and for the most part, he abandons it, right? So the short stories seem to be more that are sort of the site of experimentation than they do the site, at least for voice, of sustained commitment.
Yeah, that's good. That makes sense.
And so the Pale King, then, since you've written so much about it, I mean, give us a sense there in that there are a lot of different characters, but are there, are there a lot of different voices that you're interested in, or is it mainly that author here persona?
It's actually not the author here persona that I'm interested in. The author here, Persona, I forget which critic has said this, maybe a few, basically suggesting that the author here, Persona, is Wallace parodying himself, or Wallace parodying a previous version of himself, such that, like, the author here voice is not exactly Wallace speaking to us in this sort of direct and naive fashion, but rather Wallace sort of already setting himself up as a kind of a comic figure who's ridiculous, excessive, and potentially irrelevant, much like Chris Fogel. What I'm really interested in Pale King is the voice that comes through in certain scenes, like Landine in my mind is one of the sort of cores of the novel, and coupled with Claude Silvenshine, the way that those two kind of counterpoint each other, I think we can see a lot of what the sincerity voice is aiming for.
And those different voices, are you looking at them as what we think of as like a voice that you hear? This is not like too much of a technical term, right, in this context?
Yeah. I mean, people in literary studies will tell you that voice is purely metaphorical. I don't actually think it is. I think it's partially metaphorical and partially imaginary, but I think that there's a lot of synesthetic effect that we get. And part of what is so just such a rush about reading Wallace's fiction is the way that he's so attuned to sound and rhythm and sonic patterns, the way that his sentences unfold with like an almost impossible ease has to do with the way that they actually get audiated in our inner ear, in our mind, as we read them. So like audiation is this great term from musicology I learned at a conference 1 year, and it basically means like when you imagine sound. And I think that when we're reading, authors can ask us or induce us to imagine the sound of the words to more or less degrees, and I think that's something that Wallace does a lot.
That's cool.
Now, one of the voices that trips up people a lot when they're reading Infinite Jest is Wardine B. Cry.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And that seems to me that it's more of that Girl with Curious Hair era where he's trying on a different voice, the way that like a singer would try to change their vocal range almost. And like not very successfully. So one,
that's
you know,
a question.
What do you? Well, I'm just saying. In let's say for argument's sake, not very successfully, because it does tend to take some people out of the book. That if I feel like if it were super successful, then people wouldn't stop and I don't know, be confused or pissed off by it.
Mm-hmm.
But so I'm curious, you know, what you make of that particular voice and. You know, what do you think it is successful?
Yeah, okay. So I'm actually inclined to think that it's a little bit more successful than other people do. I've read different accounts about sort of what like Black inner city speech was like in Boston at that time, and people saying like, hey, Wallace actually nailed it. Like, I've exactly heard this. I've heard these speech patterns. I've heard these, you know, markers, like these particular syntactical structures. And so on the one hand, I think, okay, like maybe we got to take just a moment before we say it's a total failure in terms of its mimetic quality. Now, I take your point. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah,
Esther
it is
said a similar thing about that, too, about her experience in Chicago.
Okay, yeah.
Well, and I mean, for me, and I'm really not speaking for myself so much here as just speaking as like it's a controversial part.
Sure,
of the
yeah,
book.
That's
yeah, sure, it sure is.
It's uncontroversial to say that it's a controversial part of the book.
And like I'll tell you, when I first read it in the book in 1997, it was not an issue for me at all. I was just like, huh, here's you know an African American character, and like I grew up in rural East Texas where people talk differently, especially in different socioeconomic classes. And the high school that I went to was like 70% black. And so I heard all kinds of different accents and speech patterns that did not translate to the other part of town. Yeah. So I think there were people in my actual town who were like, oh, people don't talk that way. And it's just because they had not gone to my high school and heard it. I think that's a fair point, too, is just like, just because it doesn't sound real to you, who maybe, you know, if you grew up in West Virginia or Canada, it's like, well, that's not authentic to me. It's like, well, maybe that's okay.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. So I take your point, though, that it's a little bit anti-immersive. And I guess there's maybe two things that I would say that I think about that. One of them is that in the same vein I was talking about before, about Wallace's interest in the Sonic, that he's really interested in mediating character voices as sonically audible, right? Not just as, you know, a collection of words on the page, but as distinct, you know, accents, distinct, you know, like weird vocal tics. And so I think that's part of what he's trying to do there, you know, at least what his aim is. And the other thing I would, I guess, say about Wardy and Becry is that the novel's an encyclopedic novel, and it would seem really sort of dishonest and irresponsible and maybe disingenuous of Wallace if he were to write an encyclopedic novel that at least didn't attempt to find a place for multiple races and classes and the way that they talk in it.
Dialects, yeah. Yeah. I think that's true.
Yeah, and I think that's fair of other, you know, encyclopedic novels that engage with different types of characters. I just think it's more, like you said, more fraught now, in a way that it maybe wasn't when he wrote it, which was probably, you know, the early, actually late 1980s.
Yeah, because he wrote that when he was in Arizona.
Arizona, right, yeah.
Right, right. So that's an interesting part, but what, when you were reading Infinite Jest, was there a part of it that made you think, wow, there's something really, meaty and interesting going on here with voice?
I mean, at every point,
like the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's such an amazing novel, and it does so much. Part of what I've been thinking about a little bit lately is the way that the novel blends first and third person, because you get, you know, we start out with Hal in the first person, and then we immediately turn to, like, this deep focalization with Erdedi, and then we sort of trickle back into a more distant third person narrative style. But we still, actually, I've been going through the novel this week and sort of sectioning it out for this kind of digital analysis I've been trying to do, and the first person keeps coming back, like, way more than I realized. I mean, even when it's not overtly made clear that it's Hal, there's a voice that says, you know, I've had these dreams and I was, you know, thinking, and it just sort of comes and goes in this very delicate way that is pretty fascinating. So that does something with voice. That does something very strange with voice. And even when the first person isn't there, even when we just have the kind of authorial voice of Infinite Jest, that voice is funny, is smart, is attentive, is, you know, dynamic. And so that's part of what I try to get at in the chapter that I read about Infinite Jest, is not just that it's this encyclopedic voice. The encyclopedic voice is not a computer trying to tell us information. It's a human who genuinely wants to share ideas and knowledge. And as Wallace says in an uncollected interview, he says he wants to give knowledge a flavor.
I think he's pretty successful on that front.
Yeah.
I got a lot of flavors from that book.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, what's Wallace doing with voice and Infinite Jest? He's giving ideas a flavor again and again and again.
That's super, I mean, that's super interesting to me. And my one question I have about that, like, the thing about flavor makes me think, well, I thought differently of some of these passages whenever I first heard them on the audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
Like, have you listened to the audiobook of it with Sean Pratt?
No, I haven't. I've been like pretty tentative about getting into the audiobooks because in some way I'm kind of like protective of the voice that I hear in my head. Mm-hmm. And Wallace's comments about like this prose isn't meant to be read out loud, it's meant to be heard in your head, and so I've like stayed away. But tell me about what you hear.
Well, I think it's like it's almost like a translation in a way. Yeah. Because you know, with a translation you have to make a decision of, you know, let's say you're translating Infinite Jest into Korean, well, or Spanish, do you translate the Quebecois French, or do you leave it in Quebecois, or do you say, well, in Spain we have Catalan, which is kind of like Quebecois is to Canada, so we'll translate that into Catalan. Like those kind of like structural decisions, I think the audio narrator has to make as well. And whenever I read to my kids at night, you know, you can just read the whole thing in a really bland kind of neutral voice, or you can try to have a different voice for each character.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the audiobook of Infinite Jest does that to a tremendous degree. And there are, you know, because there are so many different characters, there are so many different types of voices that he's attempting there. I'm thinking of like Idris Arsani.
Yeah, that's the first one I thought of too. Yeah, we asked Sean about that when we had him on. Like, was that a choice that you made? Was that a choice that the producers made? Was that a choice that the publishers made? You know, and he's like, no, it was like I was given creative control to do what I wanted with how I represented the text in that way. So he came up with all the like, you know, accents and regionalisms and stuff like that in the audiobook.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a amazing task.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, it's 56 hours long.
Whew.
You know, I wonder, like, if you see, we talked about some of the influences at Broom of the System, but like what kind of, you know, there's encyclopedic influences, I would say, from, you know, for Infinite Jest. But like what parts of those influences did you dwell on or pick up on in your dissertation?
The one that I focused the most on for Infinite Jest was actually James Joyce. The way that sort of Joyce does or does not connect to Infinite Jest, Infinite Jest, you'd never be able to boil it down to one influence, say. But I wanted to kind of talk about the way that register and register switching is a really fundamental part of how Wallace's voice works in Infinite Jest. And I also wanted to talk about how the kind of ethics about knowledge and the totality of the story world and what we do or do not know about it and what we can know or cannot know. Those two things align really well with what Joyce is doing in Ulysses.
Hmm.
And I actually have like a specific scene in particular where I read it very closely against Joyce and show not only that Wallace, I think, is writing with Joyce in mind, but that he actually lifts like a particular word from Joyce. So sort of Joyce's trace is there.
Fantods?
Is that what?
Fantods?
No.
No, I'm just kidding. That's from Mark Twain.
Yeah. No, it's apposite.
Oh, yeah.
And this is actually, it's not Ulysses, actually. It's Portrait of the Artist.
Oh, okay.
It's not even Portrait. It's Stephen Hero. And Wallace's copy of Stephen Hero is in the archive, and I've had the pleasure of looking through it, and it's marked somewhat minimally, but all of the passages about Epiphany and Stephen's aesthetic theory have been lined in multiple pens. Hmm. So you can kind of tell if you get a sense for which pens Wallace is most likely to use at what point in his life. Like he doesn't start using the felt tips until a bit later. You can basically tell that he's read it in college and he's marked it in college and then he's come back to it later.
Mm-hmm.
And my argument is that while he's working on Infinite Jest, and he's read it and marked it again. And so he's coming back to this book again and again to try to think about like textual aesthetics, epiphany, how to write epiphany in, you know, the postmodern or the post-postmodern age, and how to kind of make those epiphanies come through, say, on the level of the text, and not just as, like, not just telling the reader that a realization has taken place, but sort of showing how that realization is part and parcel of the language by which it's told. Hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. And I think that probably not enough work has been done on Infinite Jest and Ulysses as well. Like, just overall, I think it's actually a really good fit.
Yeah.
For a lot of ways.
Stephen Byrne has outlined a lot of them. But, like, Stephen is such an amazing and ambitious critic that he just, like, tosses off these little comments like, oh, well, the character alignment of Infinite Jest and Ulysses is, like, pretty much the same, right? You get a younger man and an older man with one goes up and one goes down. And then you're like, oh, shit, you know, like... And then Stephen moves on, you know, in his analysis of Infinite Jest and goes and says a bunch of other brilliant things. But so I pick up some of those moments that he has written about, some other moments that people have talked about, Epiphany and Wallace and stuff like that, and then some of these cool archival moments that I've been able to find to be able to talk about it. So I think that people are interested in it, and it's just a matter of time before we start seeing maybe more engagement. I mean, it's hard because, you know, Infinite Jest is already a lot to read, and then you gotta go read Ulysses.
Yeah, right.
And then, oh, you're gonna dive into Finnegan's Wake too? Like, Wallace has some Finnegan's Wake jokes in his college humor mag, Sabrina.
Oh, wow.
You're just like, dude was reading Finnegan's Wake in college? Like, all right. What are we going to do with that?
Oh, yeah. I remember the first conference, the 2015 conference that I presented at in Illinois, on my panel, Anna Carlina Warner gave a paper on Ulysses and Infinite Jest, and Rob Short was on that panel too. Having not read Ulysses ever, though, I was like, okay, that's cool. I don't track with the Ulysses stuff all that much. But yeah, I know that people have definitely thought about that to a certain extent. It's
well,
not going to be
think
me, though.
One difference is, like, if Wallace is writing about, you know, if he would never directly acknowledge that, I think, like, it's so buried, like, a lot of the parallels or the influence of it is sort of woven very subtly into the book. Mm-hmm. Contrast that with John Updike, who does have couple of short stories where he will have a character just straight up say, like, oh, I remember when I was reading Ulysses and, you know, this word really stuck with me. I don't know if you know this story, Yonina, but Updike has this story, Wife Wooing. I think it was originally
Maples. Yeah, I was gonna say that's in the Maples. I haven't read that one.
Yeah. But anyways, the guy pulls out the word smack warm thighs, like smack warm, and it's straight from Ulysses, but like he just straight up says, like, I'm going to now riff on this word as like it's such a direct, it's like, oh, well, there's a Ulysses reference or influence. It's like, it's not even an influence at that
right,
point.
Yeah.
Whereas I think Wallace was able to take a lot of influence and like, not be so overt about it, but build it more into a new thing. You know, I mean, that's what interests me about what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, with Wallace, it's so hard because he's sort of throwing so many explicit references at you that it can be very tempting to follow up all of those. And so, you know, I think in some ways the sort of, I mean, that's the initial track that Wallace criticism took is like, oh, okay, like, yeah, you know, Westward is about Barth, like, let's figure that out. But then there are all these submerged ones and all these hidden ones, even ones that Wallace sort of explicitly disavows, and those are the ones that maybe
like
have
Pynchon.
A lot more, yeah, like Pynchon, yeah. You know, oh, I only like 25% of Pynchon. Oh, yeah, okay, all right, yeah. You also never read Crying of Lot 49,
yeah.
We all believe that.
Uh-huh.
And so...
He lied. He definitely lied.
The disavowals are the ones maybe where there's a lot more maybe anxiety at stake for Wallace, and that's where I tend to go.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about something in your dissertation about going back to Broom, but it really, I think, affects Infinite Jest as well. And that's Wallace's humor or comedy. And, you know, that to me, in some cases, seems almost like a defense mechanism to put the reader either at ease or off guard. And like, how does he use comedy and slapstick? And I ask, as you had mentioned something in there about the influence of like almost like Looney Tunes and Mad Magazine, which were big influences on me as well. So
yeah, I had some Mad Magazines. Cracked.
Oh, absolutely. Cracked, yeah. So
Garbage Pail Kids.
But how does that work into your overall argument, like his use of comedy?
Yeah. So this is something that I didn't get enough of a chance to develop in that chapter, because that chapter just started going and going and getting bigger and bigger. Try to write about Wallace and then about Pynchon too.
Yeah.
But I think you're absolutely right to say there's something here that links. I don't even think it's just Broom and Infinite Jest. I think it goes all the way through. And what ultimately it comes down to, in my mind, is the question of the grotesque. Because Wallace is interested in grotesqueries, in things that are ugly or gross. He's interested in disgust, right?
Objection. And yeah.
Objection, yeah. And the way that we are sort of pushed and pulled by those things that are kind of abject in our perception. And so I think that's like a dominant aesthetic in the kind of the cracked magazine aesthetic, right? The drippiness and pimples and
garbage pail kids, like, comes to mind here as well.
It's totally,
it's like you're describing Mario too, like Mario in Cadenza. Mm-hmm. Disgusting.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yeah, you actually start to think about what Mario looks like and you're just wait a minute.
And also not even Mario, but like a lot of the other tennis kids, you know, the gorilla forearms and like all like just their sports bodies, which are like weirdly Adonis like in some ways, but then also, you know, very bizarre and absurd and disproportionate.
Yeah, I mean,
in others,
their forearms of their you know, forehands are like grossly bigger,
gorilla like, yeah. Squeezing the tennis ball.
The lemon pledge.
The covers.
And then Lyle licking the sweat. That's grotesque. Like there's a lot of, not to mention all the AA stuff that gets really quite unsavory.
The AA stuff. Yeah. One of the moments that I go to for Wallace dealing with the grotesque, and I haven't written about this scene, but I really want to, is the woman who's a crack addict who has the stillborn baby.
I was just thinking of that too.
Yeah,
that scene is haunting. I think about it all.
That
the time.
Is, yeah. That's a moment where I think that Wallace doesn't quite pull off what he's trying to do, because he handles it. He holds it so serious and so intense. And then he just kind of starts dropping the ball, and he starts treating it as like this sort of abject, grotesque humor. And he starts injecting this kind of weird humor into that moment, which seems almost inappropriate.
It's like lethally unfunny to me.
Yeah. You know. And so it seems like, I think you're absolutely right, Matt, that humor in some ways is a defense mechanism. And that, so Wallace, you know, it has this positive side of engaging the reader and making us laugh and making us kind of have fellow feeling. But then when you have moments like this where he's like trying to pull off something really, really sad, and he just falls back into his comfortable mode of humor. Mm. And you can see the other side of what humor does and maybe where it is a point of vulnerability for him. And then, and then I don't even know. I mean, talking about humor in Pale King is like, I think about the, Tony Ware and the whole episode of the booger. The like strange bloody booger that she has, that she like wipes on her shirt front and says that the clerk has done this to her. And I don't know.
I mean, she grew up in a trailer park, right? So she's not exactly the most well-mannered person, but she is fiercely loyal. I really like that character a lot.
Oh, me too.
I think that's one of his best female characters he ever did. But I'm also thinking of the Meredith Rand section when she's talking with Drinyan. And, you know, that is an extended voice exercise. It's really just like a dialogue. Although there's a weird, like, narration scene in there.
With levitation.
Well,
there's a weird, like, third person. You know, what you were saying earlier about Infinite Jest having, like, switching between first and third person a lot. I think there's also a fair amount of that in Pale King, because it's also cobbled together with all these different sections. But, you know, what, like, from your project, what parts of the Pale King do you think are, you know, just gold?
Yeah, the ones that I'm most focused on when I write have to do with the Landine section where he and Sherry are up by that lake, or how's it go?
Yeah,
good people.
Yeah, the good people excerpt that was published in the New Yorker, and then I talk about the first section, the read these section one with the worms and the by the highway, and then I talk a little bit about Claude Silvenschein in the shuttle bus on the way to the IRS.
Oh my gosh!
And the way that
gives me the phantoms.
The way that he's looking at this other guy, I forget who the name, who's having this deep memory as he looks out onto the field that looks like the armpit of a girl who hasn't shaved, and having a memory about his first time having sex. So those are the three ones that I engage thinking about Pale King, because they kind of each offer like this kind of very sonorous, nature-oriented and like ethically engaged sexual politics engaged kind of voice.
Well, I have a little rant about that opening passage, which you're now going to have to endure.
No, please. I want to hear what you. I want to hear your rant.
Well, I'm just not convinced that it was even meant to be part of the Pale King, and this is an editorial decision that Michael Peach made to make the book a certain way. And whenever Wallace died, he left this clean stack of pages on his desk, and there's a lot of, you know, questions like, what was that clean stack? And I think it's in David Herring's book, but also Dan Max's. I'm pretty sure that the first stuff that was in there was the author here, and that
right. That was at the top of the stack.
Right, and the thing that opens the Pale King now was published in Tri-Quarterly magazine as a prose poem
in
2002 called Peoria 4, and then there was another one called Peoria Number 9, and when it was reprinted as part of the Pale King, Tri-Quarterly somehow didn't get acknowledged on the hardcover or paperback copyright page of the Pale King, and in a way it's like erasing the provenance of those pieces, which Wallace could have published literally anywhere, but put them in small literary magazines rather than like in Harper's or the New Yorker, where all the other excerpts were published. And I just believe that they have nothing to do, just because it had the word Peoria in it, and at one time the book was called Peoria, What is Peoria For? I believe that they were written not as part of its novel project, but as some other like voice exercise, almost what you were saying. He was very influenced by judging all of those prose poems when he reviewed the best prose poems book. So anyways, that's my rant, is I don't believe that they were meant to be part of the Pale King, much less this sort of like emblematic exemplar opener of the whole damn thing. And it's like, if the book starts with the author here, it's a very different book.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. And I, one of the things I'm hoping that we learn more about, you know, as the critical project goes on, is like, what exactly Peach did, in much more specific terms, with the manuscript and the materials that he found. So, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to open the novel that way. Now, given your criticism, let me ask you one thing. How do you...
You're not allowed to ask me questions, I'm sorry.
Peoria 9, I mean, Peoria 9 gets integrated into stuff with Tony Ware. I mean, Peoria 9 is Tony Ware's childhood.
I think that he wrote in a very disjointed way, and there's nothing else. I don't know. I think it's a bad decision to open the book with it. Mm-hmm. Even though it's a very beautiful passage, I think that it's very lyrical. Peoria number 9 is great too. I like all of it. I think that it's very of high literary quality. Whether or not it fits as that part of the book or the book at all is questionable to me.
Do you think it front loads the book too much, too heavily in the favor of like a sincere voice? The universal brotherhood of all things.
Maybe that's my feeling of that if it opens with something where he's parodying himself, well, that's still parody. Maybe that would have been confusing to people. I don't know. I feel like it's a tough task. I'm glad I didn't have to assemble that book. But I just don't think that it was in Wallace's mind as the opener of a novel.
Yeah. I mean, would you go so far as to say that as a result of the editing process, you don't think that The Pale King is by David Foster Wallace? I've heard people say that.
That's touchy.
Yeah, I've heard people say that, and I think that's too extreme for sure.
Yeah, that's too extreme for me.
Yeah.
That it's co-authored by Michael Peach in a way. Yeah.
You know, what if you put yourself in Michael Peach's shoes and you look at how Wallace organized Infinite Jest? He didn't.
Yeah, he
opened it with Hal. Yeah. I mean, with the first person Hal, which is like, where does that go?
Yeah.
You know? So maybe the kind of very disjunctive opener is true to Wallace's patterns in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, speaking of...
I don't know. For a long time, the opener of Infinite Jest, up until the final draft, was that professional conversationalist scene. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And there is a draft in the Ransom Center where that scene, he started out where it was, you know, the dad was named Jim, but the son was not named Hal. It was named David Foster Wallace.
Oh, right.
And, you know, Jim is his dad's name. Mm-hmm. and throughout the rest of the book, he kept that part in. And I think, that would be a different book. Would Infinite Jest even be as good? You know, would it be as good if it were rearranged differently? That's a pretty abstract question as well.
I do not think it would be.
I think that's a good answer, actually.
That's actually one of the things I've been trying to work on as my dissertation kind of closes and as I get started on the next big project. Has to do with what I see as the fundamental importance of order in these mega novels, and the way that order in these mega novels does not get really paid much attention to, because people tend to treat them as these sort of flattened networks of story. And so instead of thinking about how, okay, well, we get this and this and this and this, the focus critically is on, okay, well, sure, we get it in that order we get something in order because it's a text, but that's not really what matters. What matters is these texts are trying to, you know, reach to the sort of nonlinear hypertextual and so on. I want to say, no, order is so important, and it's important to Infinite Jest, and the way that Infinite Jest unfolds, for instance, is so engineered. It's actually insanely engineered, as far as I can tell so far, the balance by which we get different introductions to character, different articulations of some of these initial worlds. If you were to jumble up the sections of Infinite Jest and put it in a box, I don't think that would be a successful novel.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fantastic point, because what is writing other than putting certain words in a certain order, and at a larger scale, putting, certain chunks of words into certain order?
Yeah.
That's what writing and rewriting is. And I, you know, I think that because there has been a lot of textual analysis of Infinite Jest, it sort of proves your point, is that, you know, he went through draft after draft of adding things and cutting things and moving them around for a reason, not just, you know, randomly. And, you know, what those reasons are, I think, are complex. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of a scene that was early on in the book where it was about Avril having an affair. And, like, what kind of book would it be if you encounter that, even in the first 100 pages? You know, would that change your impression of Hal and his mother? But that is also somewhat, like, modeled on Hamlet, I think.
And yeah.
Hamlet and his mother. And, like, whenever people are introduced in Hamlet, I mean, there's so many different decisions that are made there. I would love to read more about that. So you have my permission. Go do it.
Oh, thank you. All right. Hey, I've got a reader.
Two. Make that two. I'm in. And speaking of other projects you've been working on lately, you were recently in Victoria, BC at UVic doing a one-week institute. And you broke it down for me what you were up to there and the kind of sort of digital data analysis you were doing on Wallace's work. And I think that would be a rad thing for our audience to hear a bit about what's been going on there in your graphs and charts that you're making.
Oh yeah. graphs and charts.
I love them.
So let me just do a shout out for the Digital Humanities Summer Institute, because, and also I'll give a shout out to the Modernist Studies Association who sponsored my stay there.
Right,
Thank you. Thanks MSA for the scholarship. I had a great time, like even better of a time than I thought I would, learning about style analysis and using some really, you know, pretty brilliant but also relatively easy to use statistical programs to think about style and to think about how style works. So the class I was in was called stylometry, and that's just a fancy word for, you know, like the ometry of style, right?
Easy.
I know. I would say this to people, and they were like, "Whoa, stylometry! Like, what's that?" And I'm like, "It's really, you know, a lot like less fancy than it sounds." But I was checking out. I wanted to test some of the conclusions that I made in my dissertation and say, "All right, you know, I've done this analysis. This is incredibly close reading." Informed, incredibly, you know, like my take on these novels. And while I think it's defensible and, you know, put my scholarly self behind it, you know, sometimes you just want to say, like, maybe somebody read this differently. And is there anything here that I can point to that has this sort of more global effect? Because part of the problem with talking about voice is that you end up talking about scenes rather than novels as a whole. And so part of what I think the statistical stuff I wanted to see is, well, it allows you to kind of crunch the numbers on whole books and see which ones are similar to which other ones, which, you know, in what ways they're sometimes different. One of the things I did was I broke up all the short story collections and put all of the stories as like individual files through a program called Stylo to do this analysis of how they're related to each other or not. And so you can kind of see these sort of clusterings. It's really fascinating where, for instance, a lot of the Girl with Curious Hair stories cluster by themselves. Some of them cluster with some of the brief interviews. And then most of the Oblivion stories actually tend to kind of do their own thing, like, with each other. And so, you know, just to look at the graph that I made, you can kind of see moments, say, in the career where Wallace is actually changing what he's doing. There is a fair degree of overlap as well. And there's so much work to be done on this because the thing that I was doing was so elementary. It just looks at word frequencies. Just the word frequencies of, like, the most basic words of the it, I, and stuff like mm-hmm. that.
A lot of prepositions and stuff, you said?
Yeah, prepositions, yeah. Function words. Mm-hmm. And those are actually some of the most durable indicators of authorship, and stylometry is originally organized as kind of like a way to determine authorship for anonymous texts. So it's oriented around finding authorial fingerprints. But if you kind of turn the dial on some of these programs just up a little bit, mm-hmm. so it's looking a little bit more fine-grained, you can see differentiation even within an individual author. So that's kind of what I was looking for is, all right, what does this program think the differentiation in Wallace's short stories looks like? Which one of them, say, have statistical frequencies that are similar or different? And I had some cool preliminary findings. I have to do some more, but mm-hmm. I'm also now like splitting Infinite Jest up into chunks, and I'm going to put it through a similar process to see which portions of the novel does this program think are similar and which does it think are different. Just, you know, see what it says and see ways that I could like refine the method mm-hmm. to make it maybe reveal new moments that I could focus on mm-hmm. and how I could potentially test what I've argued myself.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Maybe you can send us the shot of your graph and I can include it as one of the images for this episode.
I can
like on
can
Instagram. Or, okay, sweet.
You know, I'm not necessarily proud of it, but
you know, should be. I thought it was cool.
As long as everybody knows it's preliminary, I'm sure. happy to share. And uh-huh. if anybody's interested in learning more about this kind of analysis, I was skeptical at first, but yeah. I mean, you know, feel free to reach out to me, and I'd be happy to tell anybody more about it.
Cool.
It seems like that tool would be useful for writers as well if they were able to figure out how to work it, tech savvy enough. Then, you know, I know there are a lot of writers who are self-conscious about overusing some words or using the same word too close to each other, and so they spend a lot of time going back and forth just looking at like word frequency during revisions.
Oh wow, yeah.
So I mean that would be something that I think writers would be curious mm-hmm. to see the results of their own work. I'm curious just like on a technical level, like how much text can you feed in and parse yeah. with it? Or like, have you tried like putting in all the novels in or something like that?
Oh, you can do enormous corpuses. Yeah. I mean, the stuff that we were playing around with during this week-long seminar, we had like the practice corpus was 100 English novels. And that was pretty easy. Like, some of the stuff that our instructor put up on the screen of things that he had done were thousands and thousands. And then, you know, there's ways that you can manipulate the data and get it into network visualizations so that you can see kind of in more detail how things cluster with each other.
Sweet.
So, and what does that mean? Like, if things cluster with each other, you know, what does that really mean?
It means, according to the parameters that you've set, in what ways are they more similar to each other or more different? So, like, it basically takes numerical values that correspond to how often a particular word is used, and then it translates them spatially. Does that kind of make sense?
So like sort of you can sort of visualize like where things are related or not, or clustered together, like you said, grouped together, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, this is part of like a lot, there are a lot of like humanities scholars in particular who kind of only do this sorts of analysis, and it's sort of foreign to me. I mean, where do you see this like go? Like, is this going to be a larger part of your research? Are you more interested in doing things like this? Or, you know, what is your take on that in terms of like digital humanities in general?
I think that it has an enormous number of applications for so many different types of projects that it's, I don't even know yet how I might continue to use it in different ways. But in terms of the kind of work that I do, I think the visualizations are in some way the most valuable, because when you're somebody like me who likes to write about the, you know, structures and organizations of these enormous novels, at some point you just, you know, a graphic really helps. Say, like, like I did this analysis of Infinite Jest by comparison to Broom of the System and Pale King, and the program kind of broke down where the text in Infinite Jest resembled more that in Broom, and where it resembled more in Pale King, and then like color coded them green and red, and put it on a line, like put it on a bar, and you can just see like green, red, green, red, green, red, green, red, green, red, and like wider, shorter. That's part of why I said that Infinite Jest is so intricately engineered in terms of its development, because it's kind of shifts, its internal shifts seem really measured based on that kind of visualization.
Cool.
So that's how I might continue to use it, looking at other big novels, comparing the way that they're structured, say, to the way that Infinite Jest is structured. We'll see.
Cool.
Like Ulysses? Like, what are some other books that you're interested in? Like, I'm curious now.
Yeah. Well, DeLillo, Underworld.
Underworld,
for
I was
going
to say. Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah. Gaddis, The Recognitions, Ulysses, of course. What other big things? You know, Gravity's Rainbow. All these big monster fictions.
J.R. I don't know.
J.R. I have not plunged into J.R. yet. I read, like, the first two pages, and I thought, it's got to wait until I finish my dissertation.
It's long. It's very long.
Yeah. I also have recently started The Tunnel by William Gass.
Oh, God.
So. Uh-huh. I mean,
oh God.
My intuition is that a lot of these big novels that get chalked up as maximalist novels have really different ways of accumulating and of structuring themselves, and something by Gass is not going to look in any way structurally like something by Wallace, and that's a differentiation that I want to pay more attention to.
Oh, I disagree.
Really?
I think they look very similar.
Okay.
In fact, here's an example, is that in The Tunnel, which... to my credit, I have not finished. But something like 30, 40, 50 pages in, there is like an author here type section. Like there's an introduction later into the book, like the way that Pale King is sort of like, now you're at the introduction in section 9. Gass kind of does the same thing. I wonder if, you know, Wallace was influenced by that. Although that probably is a technique that goes back to like Tristram Shandy or something. Mm-hmm. So.
Sure,
Cervantes,
yeah.
Maybe.
It's probably nothing new structurally about all of these techniques. Or if there is, it's very subtle. But I think what you're doing with the voice thing right now proves the point that you can't just have like cool, interesting structures. You have to have some kind of voice that, you know, grabs the reader and pulls them in. I mean, is that kind of where you see some of the similarities with Ulysses?
Yes and no. I don't think that Ulysses has... I think part of Ulysses', you know, virtuosity is in its discontinuity of voice. Whereas I feel like Wallace's virtuosity is in having a continuous enough voice to unite everything that is Infinite Jest. I think Ulysses, let's just say Joyce is a lot more hidden than Wallace.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think that's partly why Ulysses, even if you are super familiar with the geography of Dublin, is a harder read than Infinite Jest. You know, somehow Infinite Jest now is getting this reputation of like, oh, it's this huge book you have to tackle. And it's like, actually, it's not Ulysses. It's actually quite... accessible,
more forgiving.
Comparatively.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, and like, it's neither one of them, in my mind, is as hard as Gravity's Rainbow.
Yeah, that book's crazy hard.
Yeah, and I mean, why do you think there are, I mean, I guess, is it just length that people find off-putting? Or, you know, you said that you've found other books that are like, right off the bat, not super engaging either, though.
What do you mean?
Just like what is it that makes Infinite Jest have this reputation? Is it just the length, or is there something about, you know, people flip through it and see an equation or
or a diagram of a doorknob?
That just makes them think. Because I mean, to me, that's just like part of what's an encyclopedic novel. But maybe it's just people not knowing what encyclopedic novel is when they pick it up. I don't know. I'm asking.
Yeah,
you.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe what puts people off is there it's some sense of obligation culturally to the novel, right? Because it occupies this moment in our present that is, or at least in our recent past. You know, I mean, it's aging well, but if you open it up with students today, they're like, "Man, this is so 90s." I think that, but that sense of obligation can cause a lot of resentment from people. So, yeah. For instance, you know,
like Amy Hungerford, for example.
Yeah. Whatever.
Well, she seems resentful of it for that reason, I think.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Yeah. Or just the sense
I mean,
that,
that's kind of a dumb question. So just we'll edit.
Well, my
this
mom later. Tried to read Infinite Jest, and she is typically somebody who reads like Diana Gabaldon is like her favorite writer. And I think my mom got to like page 150 or something of Infinite Jest. And she was like, you know, like I appreciate the writing, but I just have no idea what's happening with all these, like all these different characters are coming at me all the time. And I don't have no way to assemble them into any kind of coherent narrative. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So if you stick with it, that starts to congeal throughout the novel. And by the end, you can like piece together how, you know, all these storylines and mesh, but you know, it's a patience exercise that I think a lot of people are maybe unwilling to hang in long enough for to get the payout.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot of like Wallace's ethics in the novel, right? It's like, you know, the training of the mind to be patient, to kind of hold information and withhold assessment and judgment until you've kind of gotten a bigger picture. And then the question becomes like, well, how big does the picture need to be? Which is, you know, like part of what... It's part of what he talks about in the introduction to the best science writing, the desiderization essay. It's like, yeah, how much information do we need and how do we know when we have enough to make an ethical decision as citizens? I think that kind of question is modeled in the way that Infinite Jest, you know, makes you work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To access its pleasures.
I was going to say a minute ago that we... I was going to ask if you had any final thoughts, but I still have some other final questions to ask you.
Hey, why not?
So I'm not to that question yet.
I'm thrilled, Matt, that you've got so many questions for me.
Well, I try.
He tries really hard.
So, I got to ask you, like, now that kind of brought up Amy Hungerford, just about the larger, like, Me Too question with Wallace and, like, what do you say whenever people, you're like, what do you do? And they're like, oh yeah, I'm writing about Dave Foster Wallace. Like, and you get either eye rolling or some snide comment, you know, what is your response of people saying, really? Like what?
We talked about this last week, actually.
Yeah, we did talk about this. And
recap it for me.
It's really funny. So, I mean, I feel like I dodge a certain amount of stereotyping because I'm not like the imagined Wallace bro, you know? I'm like a queer woman bodied person drifting through the world, you know, in relatively non-ideological fashion as much as I can. And so you know, people ask me, what do you work on? And then I'm like, David Foster Wallace. And then they're like, what? This happened to me at a bar last week. Someone said, David Foster Wallace. Huh?
As in like they'd never heard of him? Or as in they're incredulous like, that you would spend your time on that?
Okay. Yeah, was this incredulous. In Victoria? Sort of, yeah, it was.
Holy shit.
Incredulous, sort of shocked, confused, maybe slightly disappointed.
What bar was this? Just so I have a reference point.
I think it was called like Fideo.
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. You mentioned that. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, typically I say like, yeah, I do. like, I'm not ashamed of it. I'm proud of it. And I think it's because there's a lot of sides to Wallace, and part of the story is that he did do a lot of really nasty stuff, and his personal relationships were messed up. And part of understanding him as a person is acknowledging that, facing it head on, and then saying, one, why do we still value his fiction beyond that? Mm-hmm. Because in some ways the fiction gives us a better Wallace than Wallace himself. I mean, that's how authorship works.
Right.
Yeah. And two, because understanding the fiction in connection with Wallace the author, the real author, in all of his foibles, as well as his good points, his abuses, mm-hmm. and his generosities, maybe gives us a snapshot of some of the bigger questions for sort of society and the position of the author and the problem, say, of Wallace's psyche. He saw himself as representative of an era. If that's the case, then he's not an outlier. Maybe he can tell us more about the culture and about how it could change.
Wow, that's definitely way better than what I was going to suggest you should say. Which is like, just kidding. I write about Charles Bukowski.
Yeah, really save face on that one, hey? Oh, I hope it never comes to that. Good grief.
I think that's really great. And like what you're saying is like, in some ways is, you know, you have to separate the art from the artist, that we're not here. We wouldn't be here just if this guy lived and died and wrote nothing, right? We wouldn't be talking about him.
Not a bit.
And I've never, like, for any book recommendation, I've never tried to say like, oh, also the writer's a really great person. Like, yeah. Who gives a shit? Like,
the writer didn't any crimes.
That might be a disincentive. Sure. Like, I'm not selling you that, like, every time I recommend a book to someone that it's like, oh, and the guy's really upstanding more.
Yeah, usually if you recommend a book and you're like, oh, and this person, like, did time and they wrote about, like, you know, this, like, rough child, and people are like, oh, okay, that sounds interesting. You know, like, that's not banal at all, like my life is, you know?
So I mean, it's a really interesting question, and I think it's one that, sort of as critics, maybe we still have to grapple with, but at Finnegan's Wake reading group a couple months ago, you know, we talked about this, and we went around the table and we said, you know, what authors do we love who aren't assholes?
Yeah.
And like Beckett was the only George one Saunders. We could really come up with. I don't know, George.
George seems like the sweetest man in the world to me. So.
He's a pretty good guy, actually.
Like, when I think of, like, someone who I, you know, like, if I didn't have a dad and someone I, like, could have as a dad, I think of George Saunders.
But, I mean, that's maybe misleading, because a lot of what we knew about Wallace during his life was mm-hmm. how generous he was to people, how, like, self-effacing he was, how shy, and how, like, he answered everyone's letters, and mm-hmm. he was so nice.
That's absolutely true, and then all that stuff came out after his death. Then, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. So... I don't know. Who
good point.
You know?
I actually do this. I do this sometimes to, like, comfort myself. If I find someone who I think, like, oh, I'm starting to look up to this person or admire them, I will intentionally go try to find something.
You bad run their criminal record check.
Yeah, or that they failed to do. And like Paul Newman is an example. It's like, oh, he's a great guy. Gave all his money to charity. It's like
all the salad dressing.
Such a
money.
Loving husband. It's like actually not a great father.
Wow.
But I would say, like, that that temptation to try to either find good or bad in a person is not a critical response to art
right.
at all.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very, like, lurid response that I feel guilty about. But it's difficult because, I mean, I had a thing come up recently where someone said, like, oh, David Foster Wallace, isn't that rapist guy?
Yeah, didn't he rape a 14-year-old? Isn't that what someone
said?
And
I was like, jeez. No, that's not. Yeah. I was like, no, that's not him. He's like, well, I just read something bad about him. And I was like, oh, God.
If you just, that's the sort of garden variety. I've read something bad about someone, and that's just what we go for.
Yeah, and it's like, well, you know, get in line, because there's plenty of other bad things you can read about. Mm-hmm. But it's difficult. I mean, it's not difficult, but it's something that's like, you know, it has to be dealt with, because there is a lot of, I don't know, conversation about it. People want to talk about it, you know?
Yeah. I think Wallace himself would actually say you're doing the right thing. He doesn't, he's constantly in favor of de-idealizing others, right? Because to de-idealize another is to treat them in some way as an object. And that's part of what, like, Joël Van Dyne is all about. You know?
And he didn't have many heroes himself, you know?
Yeah. Kafka, maybe.
Don DeLillo, maybe. Kafka. Mm. Well, I've really enjoyed this, Yonina. Thank you for being on the show tonight. Do you have anything else that you want to, that you had wanted to mention or talk about that we did not get to yet?
Well, I had a question for you.
Oh, God.
I saw on Instagram that you had Steve Moore there in Austin.
Oh, yeah, just like that.
I did.
What's...
I did. It's been an interesting couple days.
You're hitting the archives with Steve, so, huh?
Yeah, so my buddy Stephen Moore is in town, and he is working on a book about Alexander Theroux.
Fantastic!
Theroux sort of treats Stephen Moore as his personal archivist, and Stephen Moore has... sold a bunch of his Theroux papers to the Ransom Center over the years, and now that he's doing this book, I went back to kind of tie up some loose ends for his book by going through that stuff. And so, yeah, we just had a good time going through all of his papers with Theroux, going back to like 1981 up to now. Theroux is like 80 years old, still lives in Cape Cod. And if you're listening out there and you have not read Darkinville's Cat, it is out of print, but I think it is, you know, a lengthy, super interesting novel. A lot of different voices in that book.
Super funny.
It's super funny and like bizarre and strange in a kind of very unique way. So I highly recommend Darkinville's Cat.
And on the other side of things, you know, Stephen Moore's The Novel and Alternative History is like transcendent scholarly work. So I'm glad to hear he's, you know, doing something with contemporary novels now too.
Well, you know, he did that. The first volume is Beginnings to 1600. And you're like, what? I thought the novel didn't begin until 1600. And I think that book particularly is enlightening and phenomenal. And then he did another volume that's 1600 to 1800. And then a couple of years ago, he collected all of his book reviews and essays on Gaddis and kind of all of his miscellaneous 20th century stuff and published it as a book called My Back Pages. That was, he says in the introduction to that book, that it's kind of like a stand-in for not doing a third volume of the history of the novel book. So I think he's kind of sees that as a completed thing. But you're right, that history of the novel, I think if you read all three of those volumes, you will have like some kind of a graduate degree conferred upon you. Like, you will learn so much.
Honorary doctorate.
The honorary degree from the University of Moore.
That's right.
I really liked his Bookworm episode with Michael Silverblatt. It's a great interview. He sounds like a very nice guy, doesn't he?
Oh,
yeah.
For sure. He is a nice guy. So, that was definitely a highlight. And we did talk about Infinite Jest and pulled out some Wallace stuff today out of the Ransom Center.
Oh, cool. Speaking of which, Matt, so, I get to visit Austin next month for the first time in my life and the archives. So I'm very excited to delve some of that with you for the first time. And Yonina, you've spent serious time there as well. We talked about last week.
Yeah, two solid weeks, 9 to 5 in it.
Yeah, so that's 80 hours. What what kind of things should I be watching out for? What's my project? Give me some homework here.
Oh, what's I don't the know. Good it stuff. Just, it depends on what you want. Yeah. I would go for the notebooks, the like black leather notebook and the My Cuddly Cuties stuff. It's got some weird folders and notebooks that have a lot of strange sort of fragmentary stuff all put together.
That's
pretty cool.
Sweet.
I really enjoyed seeing his correspondence with Bonnie Nadel. Seeing how their professional relationship sort of formed and grew, and how she really shepherded him through a lot of stuff. I don't know, pull out some of his books and look at the marginalia. It's all good. Cool. It's all good.
Cool. You were saying that you think that there's like somewhere around only like 13% of all of his, all the things that could be in the archive or in the archive.
Yeah, that was like a completely off the cuff random percentage number, but just because based on what I've learned about the amount of books that were just given away to charity shops and stuff like that. Like
immediately following his death.
Immediately following his death before Karen Green sort of realized that, you know, there was an archive here that maybe would have scholarly value because, you know, she's grieving and this is just what you need to do.
Yeah, totally.
So yeah, there's so many books that aren't in the archive, may never be in the archive, and there's so many letters, and there's so many papers and other things that we don't even know what we don't have. Right. So maybe there's a future for some of that.
Did you go to the?
I think there's. I mean, there's also just so many letters like that people are holding on to.
Yeah.
And oh yeah. I think, right.
So Stephen Moore did also just today give the Ransom Center a couple of letters that Wallace had written to a guy in Seattle named Alexander Lawrence. And they're really funny. And like, I hope we get more stuff like that, that shows up, you know, over time.
Oh, wow. Yeah, did you got a chance to look at those? If
I did. Did you screenshot them for us?
yeah, I have them somewhere. I actually think Moore had sent them to me a while ago, but they are, one of them is a guy who reviewed Girl with Curious Hair like really negatively and then sent Wallace a copy. And Wallace is sort of like, what the fuck, dude? Yeah. Like, what do you think I'm going to, like, you sent me three copies of you call my book nonsense? Like, what are you seriously expecting me to do? Go hand around these copies to my friends and relatives?
That is some,
like,
it's really fun. Congrats on your publication. Aggressive.
Like, who would do that? Who would do that?
I don't know, somebody with something to prove.
And another one is, like, I think on our Wallace Society blog, we republished this interview with Wallace from Engender magazine.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
And one is really
what year was that from, like 86 or something?
I think 89 maybe.
Cool.
Yeah, that one's, if that's the one I remember, that's, it's super cool because that's the only place that Wallace mentions Henry James.
Oh yeah.
There you go.
In like all the interviews. Anyway,
there you go.
Cool stuff. Always more.
Yes. So very exciting for me.
Yeah. Yonina, when you were there, did you go to the Don DeLillo archive at all? You check anything out there?
I peeked into it, but I didn't look through any of the manuscripts and stuff. I looked mostly at DeLillo's drafts of the speech he read at Wallace's memorial.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll check that out, too. Sounds good.
Yeah, he goes through a few drafts. Nothing super crazy in there, but it's interesting to see DeLillo's own method, especially after you've been looking at Wallace's for so long.
Yeah, I bet. Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think if there's any other cool stuff there. I mean, there's Joyce papers there too.
Right.
Guy Davenport papers there. Davenport's friends with
Hugh Kenner.
You know, Hugh Kenner. Their letters just came out recently.
Oh, right.
Stephen Moore did the index to that book.
did he?
Questioning Minds. Yeah.
Nice.
Those Davenport letters, we were actually just talking about those today. I think there's something like 16,000 letters in the Ransom Center from Guy Davenport.
Yeah. So while I was doing my Wallace marathon, my partner was actually at the archive with me, and he was looking at Davenport's papers.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
I think they have most of his papers are there.
Yeah. There's a lot of, well, if you want a real eyebrow raiser, see if you can get into Davenport's notebooks, his his diaries. You will find a lot of pornography.
It doesn't surprise me at all. Like, if you read his letters and you see the stuff that he is interested in, it does not surprise me at all.
It's amazing. Just like these clipped out nudes and then just like writing about his day next to them.
Well, okay.
All right. Yeah. So, you know, if you're looking for pro tips. Yep.
Cool. Oh, Yanita, that's great. Thank you again so much for everything you shared with us tonight. Final question. How would you rate the city of Victoria, British Columbia? 4 out of 5 stars?
Totally.
Totally. On account of that one dude in the bar who sassed you about Wallace. Dropped a star right there.
It was a woman, actually.
Oh, sorry.
But no.
I thought you said guy.
No, I loved Victoria so much. And, oh, man, the food, the weather, the people. It's great.
All right.
I'll be back.
That's a good endorsement. Matt, you heard it from the source. You got to come visit.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
I'm coming to you next month, man.
Yeah.
That's fine.
It's so good to talk to you guys. Thank you so much. And, yeah.
Awesome. If people want to get in touch with you or check out some of your writing on Wallace or anything else, what's a good place that you can be reached at?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Yonina. That's Y-O-N-I-N-A.
Yep.
And I've got a website, yoninahoffman.com. As soon as I get some of my stuff published, I'll start putting it up there. But
cool.
Until then, you know, upon request.
Academia.edu. Do you have any papers on there?
I don't have any papers on there yet, but cool. You know, I think I might start putting some stuff up because I want to share stuff with the world and I want to hear what other people have to say.
Awesome.
So
cool. Well, we'll link to all those places that people can get a hold of you. And Matt, where can people get in touch with us at The Great Concavity?
I think we're Concavity Show on Twitter and Instagram and at gmail.com. I don't know what else.
Yeah, we got Patreon as well. Yeah. That's right. We want to thank a new patron we got since the last episode, Liam Hultelid. Thanks so much, Liam, for joining the team. And Matt, I think we're almost at 50 patrons. We're a few shy of 50. So if that's something that at all interests you, check out our Patreon page. We'll link to it at the bottom of the show notes here when you click on the episode. And there's some hopefully fun rewards there that will be getting resolved soon. I think, Matt, we're coming up on the time where we should start working on our send out for the third tier patrons. So look out for that relatively soon. Well, once again, Yanina, we want to thank you so much for coming on. We also want to thank Robin O'Neill for her art associated with our show, to the band Parquet Courts for their song Instant Disassembly, and to all of you for listening. Thanks so much. Into darkness, I thought to be extinct.
All right.
You can hit stop on the recording.
You can, or you can let it run in case something funny happens. We can throw it in there somewhere at the end.
You can call me bad names.
Got the
I can
the outtakes.